Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, mounting threats to America's public lands and the wildlife they harbor. We'll spend this hour with science writer Stephen Nash, talking about the effects of invasive species, commercial development, climate change, and overuse on national parks, Bureau of Land Management property, and wilderness areas. We'll hear why the professionals charged with protecting places are forced to do so with a fraction of the necessary funding, and about the hard-to-answer question of how far back we should go in time when we try to restore a damaged ecosystem to its former glory. Our conversation starts after a short break. Years ago, President Woodrow Wilson established Grand Canyon National Park. Will it last another 100? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The park welcomed 6 million tourists last year. While its rangers also struggle to protect visitor safety, keep invasive species at bay, balance the demands of commercial development with sensitive environmental conservation, and respond to the ongoing effects of climate change. Over at the Bureau of Land Management, on the other hand, agents are tasked with providing stewardship over public property that is leased to permit holders who graze animals, drill, mine, and collect timber. It's land that belongs to all Americans collectively, but in practice, it benefits just a tiny fraction of us, and it's not expected to generate significant revenue for the federal government. Stephen Nash is visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond. He writes about these issues in his book, Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. He joins us from the studios of WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Ms. Boyd. Nice to be here.
Early in the book, you quote the science advisor to the National Park Service explaining the irony of their mission, which is preserving things in perpetuity under the limitations of annual budgets and four-year presidential cycles. Long-term conservation requires long-term planning.
Yeah, it does. Long-term planning and long-term commitment. I think we'd be better off for all our public lands if instead of thinking them as electoral footballs, we establish some kind of an endowment. And the biggest part of that endowment would be a national consciousness that their longevity matters a great deal to all of us.
It seems like that wouldn't be politically challenging because people love the parks, whether they're on the left or the right of the spectrum, right?
I think your optimism is well warranted. I think the only thing missing from the picture is a kind of a public consciousness of what these public lands are and where they are and how important they are. The national parks are the anchor of what you're describing. This is not a partisan issue. It's nothing to do with Republicans and Democrats. Every time the general public is asked, what should we do? How much force should we put behind protecting national parks? The answer is do whatever needs to be done. That's a kind of a national promise that we've always made to future generations. People are very eager to defend that promise. But they don't connect it yet to the kind of larger picture of what private interests are doing to that endowment of public lands that we have, and also what climate change is doing as it exerts pressure.
How did we begin to set aside land that would remain under control of the federal government for the benefit of all Americans? What's the history of that?
I guess the short answer is that we stole it from other cultures. We, if we're referring to ourselves as Europeans, anyway, that land transfer took place, and it's probably a history in Texas that you're even more familiar with than I am, as one set of custodians or another forced each other off that land. But there were uneven settlement patterns because mostly the interests that we had in those lands were agricultural. There were other ways to try to put them to use, to try to wring a living out of them. But there were vast open spaces that really weren't usable for much. And it also became apparent over time that when we did try to use them as individuals, sometimes we were destroying them in the process. So we created the Dust Bowl because we overgrazed a lot of those lands. And so the public stewardship of them became a little firmer as time went along. We wrecked the lands that mostly mountain lands that the national forests were on. And so they were the lands that nobody wanted. So they got turned over to the federal government because it was thought that the public at large could be better stewards of the fate of those lands and prevent them from eroding into our water systems. And then finally, there were these arid lands. Again, Texas is a repository for a lot of this kind of landscape. Sometimes they were referred to as scab lands because they had been overgrazed and gully washed, and nobody really wanted them anymore, but they were causing a lot of problems. So they stayed in the public domain, and the stewardship part of that public view of them began to be strengthened over time. But it has always been the subject of a lot of pushback from people who look at those public lands as a private piggy bank.
A lot of people, I think, don't pay much attention to federal lands beyond the places that are set aside as parks, and yet you call those places easily the nation's most single most valuable hard asset. Can you talk a little bit, and you've alluded to this already, but talk about what federal lands do for Americans?
I'll give you some for instances. You know, I tend to wax on when I get started with these things, so I'll thank you to interrupt me if I start to unspool like a street corner evangelist. But they're a valuable asset in a very immediate way. Some of those western public lands have oil and gas assets. Some of them have coal that we've been digging out of there. They are not essential to our fossil fuel repository, but they do yield tens of millions of dollars in revenues. More importantly and more irreplaceably, our national forests are responsible for 20% of our supply of clean water. They act as a kind of a wonderful filtration process. And if those forests are taking off of those hillsides by climate change or by logging, then that soil base begins to disappear and the water quality begins to decline very sharply, which is why the national forests were established in the first place. Our national parks, we've already been talking about how precious they are, and now the rest of those public lands, because of climate change, are even more essential than ever in preserving the future and preserving the promise that we've made about maintaining the wildlife, the plants and animals in those national parks, because they're going to be forced out of them. A lot of those species are going to be forced out of national parks and into cooler places where their survival odds are better.
But do I have this right? The House declared federal lands to have no cash value? What was that about?
It was, I guess, in the most benign sense, it was just a kind of a shell game. If you devalued those properties and then pushed them into pushed them out of federal control and down to the states, if you said these don't have any value, then you wouldn't be making the states pay the federal government for them. In other words, if you took this treasure house, this wonderful portfolio of natural systems and a million square miles of public land, and you wanted politically to push it back to the states so that private interests could make use of them, if you wanted to do that, you'd say, they're not worth anything. And if you could pull that off, then the states wouldn't have to pay for them and they could dispose of them as they wished.
How do land managers balance their obligation to protect federal lands with the reality that these places have commercial value as sites for grazing or logging or mining or drilling?
The way it winds up is their job is to protect those lands, the health of those lands in the public interest. But time goes by and public attention wanders as it often does. Nobody to blame for that. It just drops out of public discussion. And that means that private interests begin to exert their 24-hour-a-day full-time focus on extracting what they can from what is sometimes a very ripe situation for them. Well, that's a whole lot of word salad. Here's what I'm describing. the agency that's supposed to keep invasive species out of the United States begins to spot bugs and diseases on plants that are being imported. This is just a for instance. Often those things wind up in our natural systems very, very destructively. But if that agency, which is supposed to be taking care of our landscape, tries to intervene and say to the shippers or the nursery people who are shipping in plants or the people who are shipping in agricultural goods, if they try to say, we've got to tighten up inspection procedures, it's going to slow down the process a little, those people get upset because it costs them money. They call their congressperson, and that person calls down to the agency and begins to raise cane. Well, it's a process that happens over and over again. The congressperson isn't serving the public interest sometimes because he or she has been bought with campaign financing. His or her attention is focused very much on where the money comes from to get reelected. This is a really familiar story to your listeners in Texas and anywhere else. 70% of Americans believe that Congress is for sale. That's Republicans and Democrats. 70% of us and a huge percentage of the rest of us just aren't sure. Terrible situation, and that's what it means in terms of regulating public lands.
Just to be clear here, when we're talking about invasive species, this is the kind of thing that I think if you haven't taken the time to understand it, it can raise a kind of eye roll. People think, well, why is it such a big deal? Can you talk about what happens when non-native plants and animals start taking up residence in conservation areas specifically?
It's an interesting story. I just came back a couple of weeks ago from the Everglades in Florida, where it's a sort of an epicenter, including Everglades National Park, of course, for the invasive species. Before I start to natter on about that, I have to insert a footnote, and that is that discussion of allowing plants and animals carelessly onto our national landscape has absolutely no connection with our toxic national discussions about human immigration. After all, we humans are all one species. There's no connection between these things at all. But what can happen in the Southwest, for instance, and on much of Texas, I'm sure, is that something like cheatgrass is imported, either inadvertently or for some human use. Cheatgrass is a plant that's never been on this continent before Europeans arrived. So it doesn't have any predators. It doesn't have any natural restraints. There are no diseases waiting here for cheatgrass like there are on its home landscapes in Europe or Asia. So it goes crazy. This is paradise. It starts to spread very rapidly and very much to the disadvantage of the native species and the native ecosystems that often hold these landscapes together in a natural sense. Cheatgrass has now taken over millions of acres of the West. In Florida, there are 19-foot-long boa constrictors and pythons that have taken over the Everglades. There are so many of them, they can't get rid of them. They're big enough to swallow a 6-foot alligator.
Wow.
And some of those animals have really mean dispositions. There have been, in the last 20 years, 30,000 reported sightings of alien species of plants and animals in Florida. Often they spread diseases. The citrus crop is at risk because of a disease we've imported. Well, those are all part of our natural history now, and they have huge effects inside our national parks. What's even more important than all of that destruction that we have just, it's sort of like throwing torches onto a dry, tinder dry landscape. But while the past is important so we know where the problem is coming from, we need to look to the future. How do we put a stop to this?
Stephen Nash is my guest. We're talking about his book, Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Land versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Stephen Nash, who is visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond and author of Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Stephen, I think a lot of us became aware of the use of public land for private cattle grazing during the Bundy affair. I didn't realize until I read your book that those land leases represent a huge value to like a tiny fraction of Americans. Will you tell us about that?
We graze 338,000 square miles of public lands. There's a long list of states in the United States of America that you'd have to push together to make the equivalent of that much landscape. We lease it out for grazing, and often it is really too arid to be grazed and kept healthy. But the program that administers that grazing, the administrative program run by the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, it costs six times more to run that program than we collect in leases. You can feed your goldfish for less than it costs a rancher on public lands to feed a cow and calf. The miners who mine public lands get the same kind of sweet deal. So do the oil and gas drillers. And if that comes up later, I can go into some detail about the cookie jar that they get to raid. But that's how grazing came up. Those were the lands that those were the uses that those lands were put to historically in Texas and in Arizona and everywhere else. It's still going on. It's regulated more than it was 100 years ago, but not enough to ensure the prospects for the wildlife that's getting pushed into some of those lands. And that's going to be important. You know, I want to mention, Chris, that the projections that I used to show the impact of climate change on our national park system and our public lands, those projections were drawn up in large part by two Texas Tech climate physicists, Catherine Hayhoe and Sharmistha Swain, at my request, pulled those regional projections together. And they show that by the end of this century, in a business as usual climate scenario where we continue to misbehave on a global scale, Grand Canyon is going to wind up around the Mexican border. Yosemite is going to be as far south as Los Angeles in terms of an equivalent climate. Even Yellowstone, which is tucked way up in the corner of Wyoming, northern Wyoming, is going to be pushed all the way into Utah by the middle decades of this century and all the way to southern Utah by 2100 in terms, again, of a kind of an equivalent climate. That means the species that live in those parks have to move north to stay within the envelope, the climate envelope that they've evolved to survive within. That's a very long answer that wandered completely away from the premise of your question. I hope that's okay.
Well, sure. Since you're there, maybe we'll go back to some of the some of the land use and conservation in a moment. But are there routes for wildlife to migrate as the climate changes? Can they get safely from one sort of protected park area to another?
Thanks to this fight that our great grandparents put up 100 years ago to keep public lands in public lands or to salvage ruined lands and put them in public lands, thanks to that, in many parts of the West, there are national wildlife refuges, wildernesses, BLM lands, national forests, and national monuments, which are very large in extent, that are very connectable and that do form corridors of that kind. It's not clear to many science researchers that these species will be able to migrate because the heat is coming on us so quickly that they'll be able to adapt as they have in the past because those climate shifts have been much slower paced. But if there is any chance for their survival, it's in keeping these public lands connected. Yeah, the corridors do exist in many places, and in other places they could be created. And all it takes is the attitude that instead of denying that climate change is happening, we have to adapt and prepare for it. And this is the way we would help our natural systems that we all depend on for our survival. This is how we would help keep them intact.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phone now. We have Sam on the line in Cedar Hill. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Great discussion. Really, really enjoying this. And I'm kind of curious, and you may address this later on, but if the offer, Mr. Dr. Nash, if you heard of the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, a relatively new bill for dedicating some funds to wildlife. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, please call me Steve. And that is one of the blinking lights on the map, the political map, that we can call a great success, a bipartisan success. What a rarity in the current political landscape. I won't go into great detail. I'm not sure I have command of the detail, but basically it provides ongoing funding in a mechanism that's always been subject to political breezes in the past. It makes it much more permanent. It also adds a few things to our stock of public lands. It's definitely a step in a good direction. It's one of those occasions where you don't want to pour cold water on a good thing that's happened. But if there's just a trickle of cold water, it's to remind us to look at the broader picture in which very powerful and very well-funded political pressures are pushing back in the other direction. So then instead of connecting and protecting public lands in the way that wonderful bill helps us do, the idea is to break them up, to atomize them, to send them back to the states, and to sometimes to sell them off to private interests.
What responsibility do leaseholders have to protect or restore the land that they have used to make a profit?
If we're talking about grazing leases, they work with the Bureau of Land Management on a quite complex system of monitoring so that the health of the land is supposed to be taken care of. The result of that complicated system, that oversight that has supposed to have been going forward since the 1930s, is that even the Bureau of Land Management confesses that about a third of the land under its administration that's being grazed is not in good health. It doesn't meet the Bureau of Land Management standards. The critics of that agency, many of them science-based critics who have examined that landscape and how damaged it's been by grazing, those critics say that even that optimistic reckoning is way too generous and self-serving. A lot of that enormous landscape, what do we say, 338,000 square miles, the Bureau of Land Management shrugs and says, we don't really even know whether that's in any kind of good shape or not. So that's the agency that works with the ranchers to make sure the land is in good shape. And if you're asking how well does this system work, that's the result.
What does it take for the BLM to revoke a grazing permit?
You know, what a perfect question. Another way of asking it is, how many grazing permits have you revoked in the last 10 or 20 years?
Okay.
I asked that of Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, mm-hmm. and the answer was zero, even though the Park Administration says much of that land is overgrazed and in bad shape. Nobody has been revoked. Nobody's been disciplined. Occasionally, there's consultation and herds are reduced, which is a good, positive thing. But the same is true in northern Arizona. In St. George, Utah, which administers, that BLM office administers northern Arizona, I asked, how many grazing permits have been revoked? You've got a lot of land here that we're talking about. It's not in good health. There's severe erosion. How many cattle have we actually taken off the land? And the answer was, we leave that up to the ranchers to determine. And some of them, I feel, probably are trying to be responsible within the limits of their vision of that. But nobody is coming onto the land and saying, we're going to make the health of the land our first priority. If there's any room for cattle in that scenario, fine. Right now, the first scenario, or the first priority scenario, is we're going to serve the interests of the people that are making use of the land. They're our buddies, and they're often fine people. But that's not the point if you're trying to look after the public good and that publicly owned landscape.
So I don't want want to take for granted here that people understand why having cattle on federal land could cause damage. So for folks without a ranching background, can you talk about how, a herd of cattle could cause sustained or even permanent damage to a particular area of land?
Well, I'm with those people that you just cited. When I was driving around on the highways of the West, I'm from California, and I saw cattle out on this dry, dusty sagebrush landscape, my reaction was, what a marvel that some animal has found out a way to make a living off of this empty desolation. And what a great thing that somebody owns that cow and has found a subsistence on it, too. That's the way it looks through the windshield of a car of a casual driver like me. But when I looked into the science research, Chris, there is a long literature that explains that cattle, which are alien to the landscape, those are exotic invasive species. They come from Asia and Africa. When those cattle are allowed to roam on arid landscapes especially, they are still thirsty and they're still hungry and they eat a lot, which displaces the wildlife that also has to subsist on those landscapes, sometimes eating the same foliage. Cattle have hooves and weight above those hooves that beats up the landscape. It chews it up. It makes it subject to erosion by wind and by water. And cattle foul, as you can easily imagine, foul the very scarce water resources of the West because they gather around water, because in congregating and drinking the water and stepping through it and crapping in it, they severely pollute it and sometimes use it up. And again, that means that the wildlife that also depends on that rarity, water on an arid landscape, that wildlife is completely disadvantaged and displaced. There are lots of other impacts, but those can at least start the list. You know, we often hear, used to be buffalo, we killed them all off, we put cattle on there, what's the big deal? We replaced one species with another. And we say that because of two kinds of misinformation. One is that there never were buffalo on most of these landscapes. They are from further east on Midwestern landscapes, on big grasslands that could keep them in business. But the other thing is that cattle and buffalo are not the same thing. They may look the same to our uninformed human eyes like mine, but cattle have different kinds of hooves. They distribute their weight differently on the topsoil, and they do it in a really ruinous way in many occasions. You know, there may be cases where cattle can subsist with wildlife, with natural systems on a landscape. I would think that would be a great thing. The problem is that what we do is put the cattle on the landscape and let whatever is going to happen unfold, and then we look for justifications for it. What ought to happen is that the natural landscape's prioritized, and then we do some very careful experiments to see if any cattle can be okay on that landscape. What we do now is make an experiment out of these hundreds of thousands of square miles of public land, and we make the wildlife justify their existence. The experiment has really been a very bad one for that landscape.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, you know, talking about the difference between, beef cattle and buffalo or bison, when we talk about the conservation of any kind of wilderness area, how do we define that term? Like, is the ideal habitat one that looks like it did before the Industrial Revolution or before European imperialism or before humans existed at all?
And you can take your pick. It's a good question to ask, depending on the motive behind the question. I won't impute any impure motives to you, Chris, but sometimes it's like asking about the uncertainties of climate science in an effort to say we don't have to worry about global warming. There's too much uncertainty in the science. Mm-hmm. Well, there is some uncertainty in this question also. Which era are we going to manage the landscape back to? And we can really take our pick. within the limits of whatever climate presently pervades one landscape or another. Yeah, we could say, as is usually said, let's try to manage the landscape back to the richness, the diversity of species, the ecosystem functions of that landscape before the arrival of Europeans who tended to use the land in ways that changed it very, very rapidly and disorchestrated all those wonderful natural systems. Or you could say, no, let's go back to what was happening on the landscape before Native Americans arrived 12 to 15,000 years ago. But when you start to advance those suggestions, it's really just a wedge for a conversation that says, look, we don't know what the hell we're doing trying to manage this landscape. Let's just let the miners and the loggers and the grazers and the gas drillers take over because we can't decide what the perfect way to manage them is. I think it's a good question if you're asking it in a way that is looking for the best available science about healthy and resilient natural systems. If you're looking for a political argument, then it's not such a good question. Again, the usual answer is let's try to figure out what the landscape looked like before these very heavy and sometimes very destructive uses began to crop up in the last couple of hundred years. And sometimes the advice that I've heard from scientists is we ought to go back to Native American cultures that are still around that landscape and ask them what they still know about how the landscape looked back then. That'd be a good start.
Stephen Nash is visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond and author of Grand Canyon for Sale: Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond, Stephen Nash, whose book is Grand Canyon for Sale: Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. You can join us at 800-933-5372. So, Steve, climate change and Grand Canyon are both in the title. I was really stunned by the projections of how much hotter it will be at the Grand Canyon by mid-century.
It was a surprise for me, too, as were many of the things that I came across in this book. Grand Canyon is my foreground example through the book for what's befalling all of the national parks. And studies that have just been completed in the last couple of years show that 90% of our national parks were already experiencing accelerating heat by the end of the last century. And, of course, that's continued on. By the middle of this century, as we've said, Grand Canyon's climate is going to be like the climate has been nearer the Mexican border. By the end of the century, it'll be more or less on the Mexican border if we keep continuing the way we have been. It is quite a shock to see the maps of our national parks being sort of pushed to the south. You know, I want to mention that very good question by a previous caller, Chris, who pointed out a bright spot, a good piece of legislation that President Trump signed into law recently, which is advantageous for our national public lands. Because we have to keep up our hopes, we really need to celebrate those good things that happen. My favorite ecologist, David Orr, says, though, that hope is a verb with its sleeves rolled up. And when we roll up our sleeves and look at the landscape more generally, we have to acknowledge that the current administration has presided over what has been called the largest rollback of protection for public lands in the nation's history. Oil and gas leases on public lands have tripled in the last 2 years. An executive order just last December decreed that logging will jump by 30% on national forest lands. That's the overarching kind of situation, although it's wonderful that there are occasional bright spots to celebrate.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to John calling from Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, Dr. Nash, or Steve, as he likes to be called, expressed earlier a reluctance to entertain some questions about climate change due to a suspicion that there's an underlying maybe a political agenda, climate change denying kind of thing. And so I'm just wondering, for people who do want to have a fuller conversation about climate change that does take into account some of the questions about the science, from a truly just desire for an objective discussion, how can the really zealous climate change advocates, how can they bring, because I feel like what they're doing is pushing a lot of people away by that very reluctance that Steve brought up earlier, the sort of reluctance to get into some of the questions about the science. So how can we have a better discussion that really brings everybody into it?
Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you very much for that opportunity. Let me see if I can untangle a couple of points. I have never encountered any reluctance on the part of scientists to discuss the uncertainties of climate science. In fact, that's one of the strengths of the science. They have to model the future of climate change by putting together elaborate kinds of systems that emulate what the atmosphere will look like when you add more CO2, like we are doing now. And then that, of course, is the beginning of a very, very long list of factors that are programmed into these models. But here's what they do. They have more than a dozen competing models around the world that different international teams have put together. They operate sometimes on somewhat different premises and with different formulas underlying them. And they don't compete with each other in a way that says ours is the best model and yours is worthless. They compare the results of the projections from each of those models of the future, and they say, what explains the differences here? And what explains the differences is a level of uncertainty. And then they try to iron out the uncertainties and figure out where they're coming from. And then they look back, it's called backcasting, to see which model's projections most match or most closely match reality. If they project starting in 1850 using the same factors, which of the results looks more like what actually happened between 1850 and now? It's all about uncertainty and explaining uncertainty. That's the health and the strength of the scientific method. The kind of uncertainty, though, that you're asking about, which is exactly the right way to ask, has to do with the fact that we all kind of walk into the climate conversation not knowing a whole lot and not knowing who to trust. That was my situation when I first encountered that story, that climate story, as a journalist. You look around and you hear people bickering, and there's a whole lot of accusations of chicanery, and a whole lot of people are saying the science is no good. And you wonder, well, who do I listen to? The problem is what I call the problem of a hierarchy of credibility. There's a lot of people talking about global warming, a lot of them. And I cleave off the people when I'm interviewing who don't have any background in the science. I cleave off the people who may have some background but don't have any published research for their peers to examine, to correct, to comment on. There's a peer review process that's a quality control process for what gets published in science research journals, and it's got its flaws, but it's very rigorous, that quality control. Once you take the people with some public research, you need to ask, where did the money come from for the research? And you'll find that the tiny handful of scientists who say that there's crippling uncertainty about climate science and that climate change is an overblown kind of concern, those scientists, almost all of them got money from oil and gas and coal interests and other kinds of political interests, like the Koch brothers. So we're moving up this ladder of this hierarchy of credibility toward the uncertainties of good science that hasn't been bought and paid for by a gas and coal company, and that hasn't been politically bullied into one position or another. It isn't that that science is like religion. It's not the Messiah coming and telling us exactly what's going to happen. It's a science that says proudly, these are our uncertainties, but we are almost unanimous that this change is happening, that it's going to get worse, that it's already catastrophic. If we want to head it off from getting a lot worse very quickly, these are the things that we ought to consider doing. And then the political process takes over. If we start with the politicians and figure that they are credible enough to listen to, I think that's a big mistake.
To the extent that inadequate funding has been at least part of the problem of caring properly for the Grand Canyon and other national parks and national lands, how is it that only 3 out of 5 visitors have to pay to get in?
That situation is changing just since the book came out, but it's not changing very fast. Some of those visitors should get in for free. Our veterans certainly deserve that kind of consideration. I think people who cannot afford to go to the parks should get in for free. And it's very easy in American life to demonstrate your level of income. I'm all in favor of them getting in for nothing. But there are a lot of other people who are subsidized, like my particular demographic, old people, who have plenty of disposable income, who can easily afford to pay much, much more for the upkeep of our national parks. And they get a senior discount that's a kind of a scandal. They get it for political reasons. It has nothing to do with trying to keep the parks and their health afloat. And they're an example of a system that's kind of distorted by the politics. It's funny, when you ask people who are getting a discount, hey, if we all had to pay more, would that be okay with you? They say, I'd love to give up this discount. I asked some European students who were backpacking at Grand Canyon how much they were paying to be in the park. It was a pittance. And they said, we don't understand this. In Europe, we'd be paying 5 times this much. In Brazil, you'd be paying 5 times this much. And they said, we'd gladly pay more if everybody were paying more. It would be great to raise the prices to get into national parks. They're much cheaper than Disneyland or anything else that we happily pay for, and they do need that money. What we'd have to guard against, Chris, is if people started paying more, would that mean Congress would cut the budgets even further? I learned when I was in the Grand Canyon that they don't even have a geologist on the staff. No full-time
geologist. At Grand Canyon, they don't have a geologist.
At Grand Canyon. No.
Wow.
Nope. That's the result of really decades of not taking care of business financially to take to keep up the health of our national parks and learn as much about them as we can. We need that research and we need the maintenance.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones and speak with Alexandra in Dallas. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
So obviously, if these issues you have discussed are occurring in the United States, they must be occurring worldwide. I feel as if the topic of the ecological crisis we are currently undergoing is at the forefront, or should be, of the discussion of many nations. So I was kind of wondering what your opinion was on how to find cohesiveness with other countries in an effort to create new policies and move forward into the change for the better.
Thanks for calling.
What a lovely horizon this listener is looking out on. I really like that question. One of the things I think that we can do for that cohesiveness that any of us who care about parks and public lands would be seeking is to look to other countries as good inspirational examples for us. Because we invented national parks, because we invented wilderness areas, we're coming up in a couple of years on the 100th anniversary of the declaration of the first wilderness area on the planet. It was in New Mexico, not far from where your microphone is, Chris. And we look on that with such American pride that we've kind of lost sight of the fact that many other countries are doing a better job than we are. The whole European Union has a program called Natura 2000 that is much more aggressive in a very positive way about protecting their public resources and their natural systems. Costa Rica does a better job than we do in many respects of protecting its wildlife. One researcher who's the curator of natural systems at the Utah Museum of Natural History, his name is William Newmark. A lot of his research is in Africa, and he told me about African countries that are very much more willing to spend money and to do the science and to exert the political pressure necessary to protect their wildlife and their natural areas. So if we're looking for that cohesiveness, we could open ourselves to a different kind of way of looking at the world, that we are no longer in first place in this particular arena. Let's see what these other more successful countries are doing.
Should we be encouraged by the fact that legislation last month passed with significant bipartisan support?
Yes, yes. And this is the hopeful part of things. We've said that there's enormous bipartisan support for protecting national parks. And if people knew more about how those national parks depend on all other public lands for their future survival, I bet there'd be a lot of support for that. We really should be encouraged without losing sight of the larger picture that happy circumstance came in on. We know there's big public support for these things. It just has to be mobilized. You know, national parks didn't happen because somebody walked up to Grand Canyon or Yosemite or someplace and said, gee, this is really beautiful scenery. Let's turn it into a national park. It happened because of a political fight. It took 4 decades to get Grand Canyon declared as a national park. That fight is still on our hands. If we want our great-grandchildren to be looking at these beautiful landscapes, we've got to get involved.
Stephen Nash is visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond and author of Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. Steve, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.